I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is written that women's political power seems to be entering a new era. In President Obama's inner circle, women have had direct influence on his decision-making and in the projects to uplift girls and women worldwide, something that Hillary Clinton has championed. A landmark transition seems to be underway, he says. We might be witness to a rare succession from the first black president to potentially the first woman president. Representing inclusiveness and opportunity, values American democracy might inspire in the age of globalization. Our guest is Dinesh Sharma. He's an author, a consultant, and social scientist with a doctorate in psychology and human development from Harvard. He's an associate research professor at the Institute of Global Cultural Studies, SUNY Binghamton, where he teaches psychology, and he is currently teaching work focused on human rights, globalization, leadership, and the United Nations. He's author of the Global Obama Crossroads of Leadership in the 21st Century, and The Global Hillary, Women's Political Development in Cultural Contexts. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor Sharma, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you for a great introduction.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's start with this, which is an interesting sentence for us to start our conversation. Women's political power seems to be entering a new era. What is the era? What are you seeing?
Well, it's a global era. You know, so one of the things that's happened with the increased technology, automation, women's rights, you know, now reaching another level of development or improvement, right? Not only in the developed economies, but around the world. Women are entering, you know, jobs that were traditionally held by men, partly because of technology, obviously, partly because of the changes in the social order. So today, we're seeing a change, you know, not only in the domestic sphere, but also in the work sphere. And all of these forces are now, you know, coming together to push America at a point where, you know, 100 years after women got the right to vote, and in the 250th, almost, you know, our constitutional democracy has been around for 250 years, now we're at a point where we've nominated the first woman candidate for a major party.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, we're at a cusp. And around the world, you know, partly led by the U.S. Initiatives, there has been significant improvement based on the UN goals, development goals, millennium development goals, in women's improvement, women's education, reduction of poverty, and so on and so forth. So that's what we're looking at, and it is obviously a very positive development.
Let's look at, you write interestingly of the paths of President Obama's mother, Ann Dunham, and the path of Hillary Clinton, similar kinds of concerns on a global scale.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was quite fascinated by this conjunction that a lot of people have written about this. I think maybe a couple of books. I've written about it in my earlier books, Barack Obama and Hawaii and Indonesia. There's a chapter called Women Who Shaped Obama. Interestingly, because his father, Barack Obama Sr., left to go to Harvard and then went back to Kenya, President Obama was really raised by women for the most part, his mother, and Stanley Ann Dunham, and then his grandmother, Madeline Dunham. Both were, you know, originally from the Midwest, and then, of course, he marries and settles in Chicago, you know, meets Michelle Robinson, and marries and settles in Chicago. So these women I talk about in the book, you know, Barack Obama in Hawaii and Indonesia. Now, the parallel there with Hillary Clinton is that Hillary and Ann Dunham were really only 5 years apart. They were, you know, I say generational sisters of sorts. Ann Dunham, I think based on the historical record, is the first anthropologist mother of an American president who, you know, was born, raised in the Midwest, but then went to Seattle and then settled in Hawaii and then spent really most of her adult life outside of the continental United States in Indonesia, working for development banks and development agencies. And that's one of the strong interests, of course, Hillary Clinton has had throughout her career, going back to, you know, right out of law school, where she started working with Children's Defense Fund. So there's some interesting generational parallels. We also see, obviously, feminism maturing through their lives. And now we're at a point where the U.S. policy, U.S. foreign policy itself, in many ways, puts forth these initiatives to improve women's lives around the world. The United States spends billions of dollars around the world in terms of educational development, you know, for stopping trafficking, for building schools, you know, in places in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And so this has now become a part of the U.S. State Department's policy. And it's obviously a strong, positive initiative. That's what we're seeing potentially with Hillary Clinton becoming potentially, you know, president.
Mm-hmm. If we could talk about this Beijing conference, we're mm-hmm. aware of Hillary Clinton speaking at this conference, but what's this whole idea, which really was pretty revolutionary in lifting many women in third world developing countries out of poverty, was this micro-lending program. Can you talk about how that became a part of Beijing's policy platform, and how, as you say, while Hillary Clinton may not have heard of Ann Dunham's work in this field, she was certainly influenced by it?
Yeah, so there was a lot of controversy. This is when Hillary Clinton was the first lady, and the Beijing conference was about to take place in 1995. And this is a conference where Hillary Clinton stated, if there's one message that echoes forth from this conference, let it be known that human rights are women's rights and women's rights are human rights once and for all. Of course, the Chinese authorities in Beijing did not broadcast the speech. They pulled the plug because they didn't want it broadcast to their citizens. They thought it was dangerous. But she did make a speech. A lot of development experts were in the audience, and it had a huge impact. And in the new book, The Global Hillary, we have a chapter on this book that looks at the impact of her policies, you know, from an African perspective, from an Asian perspective, and how, you know, Hillary Clinton really is, when it comes to women's development, is the rock star that put the line in the sand and has then put in the work to improve women's lives, partly through the Clinton Global Initiative and partly as Secretary of State, and, of course, through her writing of books and so on and so forth. So that was a historic speech. Of course, it follows in the line of a lot of the post-war liberal ideas that, you know, she grew up on, and also Ann Dunham, President Obama's mother, also grew up on, you know, in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean, should she become elected, and it looks more likely, considering what's been going on, that she will become elected? What, when you talk about the values of American democracy, electing, as we have, the first African-American president, and if we elect the first woman president, the values of those kinds of elections and who we have elected, inspiring in the age of globalization, you write, the age of growing inequality and populist rage, how do we inspire just by those actions? What kind of inspiration would we see around the world, or have we seen around the world with Barack Obama?
Yeah, so for the first two books, you know, especially the Global Obama book, the reason we did that book is we found that President Obama, in his first term, in the second half of his first term, he was very popular around the world. His approval was in the 60-70% range, you know, in many parts of the world, while he was getting criticized at home. But when he, you know, when he took office, there was a huge evolutionary, if you will, jump around the world. People saw the first African-American president of the most powerful democracy in the world. People were crying, you know, in places like Jakarta, where he spent his childhood for 4.5 years, mm-hmm. places in Kenya, you know, in Nairobi, his ancestral homeland. It was a holiday for weeks, because, again, you know, I think living in this country, people don't take a lot of stuff for granted. We don't realize the influence American actions have around the world. So, you know, electing the first black president had a huge impact around the world. People who didn't know Obama personally were crying because they could relate to his story. So likewise, I was at the Brooklyn Navy Pier when Hillary Clinton sealed the nomination after winning the primaries. Women, I looked around. My daughter was also with me in the audience. My son was there as well. But I looked around, and women of an earlier generation, and even younger women, millennials, were crying. They had tears in their eyes. Because democracy, by definition, means representation, equal representation. And the more diverse our elected officials, you know, become, they represent the greater and greater percentage of the citizenry. And that's, I think, what people are relating to, right? They're relating to the fact that we're becoming more equal, more representative, and diverse candidates such as Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Of course, a lot of people are going to say to me, but she's privileged and she has a lot of power and she's a first lady, she was Secretary of State, you know, she went to the elite colleges in this country. Yes, all of that is true, but and women got the right to vote 100 years ago, we still don't have a woman president. So while the United States spends billions of dollars advocating for women's rights around the world, when we look at representation of women in this country, it's about 19% in terms of local congressional, state, Senate, and executive elected offices. So the U.S. really lags behind. Some of the reasons for that is cultural, some is economic, some is historical. So that's what we're trying to correct here. We're still trying to push for this barrier to fall.
Let's talk about the book, The Global Hillary. There have been criticisms of Hillary Clinton that should she become the next president, many people have defined her as hawkish on foreign policy, too quick to send American troops, perhaps wrong on some foreign policy decisions like the decision to go into Iraq. You write about this need to win people over by our cultural power, by leading them with examples. We've been talking about that for a long period of time, and she certainly was Secretary of State during a time when that phrase was being discussed by many. Do you see her, and what evidence do you have, that she would lead by cultural power and not military power?
Well, you know, advancing women's development is a form of cultural power. You know, it represents our ideals of equality and freedom. An opportunity for all. So that's one of the hallmarks of American sort of cultural power, if you will, right? And the idea really came into acceptance after 9/11, right? That we could kill off all the terrorists and target them, as we've been doing using drones and surveillance, but we can go into war in every country that harbors ill will against us, right? And so we're, that's the global sort of age that we're living in today, interconnected, interdependent, you know, world. We cannot resolve border disputes simply by going to war with everybody, right? So the question there is that Hillary Clinton, obviously, by pushing for what she calls the three Ds of foreign policy, diplomacy, development, and democracy, will have a balanced approach. Of course, you know, she had to be more hawkish than some of her competitors because she's a realist. She's the daughter of a World War II veteran. You know, she's seen war up close, whether it's the Balkan-Serbian war, when President Clinton was in power, or the Arab Spring, you know, when she was Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, her record, as we point out in the book, The Global Hillary, can be criticized from several angles, but, you know, she has the experience, the requisite experience, the know-how, the knowledge, and the up-close, you know, decision-making acumen to carry forth this, you know, highly powerful and demanding and challenging position.
We are going to welcome phone calls for Dinesh, and let me tell you how you can call us. It's 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email. That's talk@WPR.org. Or you can leave a message on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Would you agree with our guest who's written, you know, there are a lot of different focuses of our conversation, but he talks about women's political power seems to be entering a new era. He talks about President Obama's inner circle and all the women who have had a direct influence on his decision-making, citing specifically his mother, his grandmother, and also his wife, that the struggles of those women have shaped his self and also his identity, and that he relied on female advisors, Valerie Jarrett, Hillary Clinton, Kathleen Sebelius, Janet Napolitano, Janet Yellen, and others to be front and center when it came to formulating policy in his administration. And he also looks at President Clinton's reliance on Hillary Clinton and Hillary Clinton's role in a global environment in terms of having a woman representing certain kinds of issues that she has in the past and that she may, should she become president of the United States. But this whole idea of women's political power, and if there's a difference, too, which we'll talk about between male power and female power, does it make a difference if you're female and how you govern? She has said that half her cabinet would be female. Would she make a point of making sure that most of the staff is female? Does that mean that you pay attention to issues that perhaps men would not pay attention to? All of that's up for discussion. 800-486-8655 is our number. We'll return and start taking your phone calls in a moment. Dinesh Sharma is an author, consultant, and social scientist. He's associate research professor at the Institute of Global Cultural Studies, SUNY Binghamton, where he teaches psychology. And he teaches human rights, globalization, leadership, and the United Nations. He is the author of The Global Obama, Crossroads of Leadership in the 21st Century, and The Global Hillary, Women's Political Development in Cultural Contexts. To you in a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, two phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number. Are we at a time when we're seeing women's power really on the ascendance? Is there a backlash against that as well? And we're talking about the influence of important women in Barack Obama's life and how they helped shape him, and also in Hillary Clinton's life and how they helped shape her and how that translates into how they may govern. What do you think about all of that? Brett in Ripon is our first caller. Hi, Brett.
Hi. I'm just calling. I'm a single father of two young girls, and I've noticed, well, they've mentioned it, we're pushing the women's power, but when we're watching the news, they were talking to the average woman on the street, and they were all excited about, well, I'm going to vote for Hillary because she's a woman. And my daughters both asked me, well, that's kind of silly, just to vote for somebody because they're a woman instead of their actual policies. I mean, shouldn't we be past that as a culture by now?
Dinesh.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting question. Yeah, I mean, I think America, you know, the oldest constitutional democracy, the fact that we are still trying to get a woman elected in the White House, you would think it would have already happened by now, right? So from that, you know, from that standpoint, that benchmark, if you will, you could say, yeah, maybe there should be more balance and equality. But certainly we have to pay attention to our policies. And, you know, when we look at our platform, it's fairly detailed, it's fairly robust. On the other side, you know, last night as we saw, we didn't really hear any concrete policies, whether on Syria or on, you know, violence in inner cities, you know, economic development, taxes. You know, we didn't get any concrete issues and policies. So I think I would say, you know, people are going to vote on Hillary Clinton's platforms on November 8th. Absolutely, and they should. And gender happens to be one of the things that's going to be in the balance for some of the voters. I would say predominantly the women voters, right? And increasingly, we know, starting in the 80s, women have been voting in greater and greater numbers. So the projections are about 53% of the electorate on November 8th is going to consist of women. And, you know, based on the projections that we have so far, it seems that women are going to carry her over.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's phenomenal about this particular election cycle, too, is who she's running against. And it's interesting, we were talking about this a lot the last hour of the program, but there are people who are standing by the Republican nominee at this point, even though he has said incredibly despicable things about women, and justifying it because, well, you know, this was locker room talk. People talk this way. The Supreme Court is more important. Can you factor that into all of this? Is this a backlash against women's power, or what the heck is going on?
Yeah, I think culturally what you're seeing is, as we were talking earlier in the first half hour, what we're seeing is clearly the demographic shift in the country is taking place, is underway. We're seeing increasingly, you know, the composition of the country is changing. And having had the first black president, the White House, you know, has ginned up some of these rhetorical sort of attacks, mm-hmm. you know. And certainly, you know, Trump supporters, if you go to one of those rallies, you hear it. And it's been on video, it's been taped. You do hear a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric. You hear a lot of anti-woman, you know, anti-feminist rhetoric, you know, lock her up and all of that stuff. And you'd think you're at the Salem witch trials, you know. And so there's some of that cultural baggage that's resonating in this election. But economically, the global factor is that the country, you know, is now a global country in many ways. Our population is, you know, of course, we have the history of immigration going back to the founding, but increasingly in the global age where we're all connected through social media, you know, America is a global village in many ways. People from all over the world want to come here. America is still by far the greatest country economically, militarily, and in terms of the freedoms that it offers to people, right? So you can't put up walls. And so because demographically, as the country is changing, certain segments of the population is having a hard time digesting that change.
Mm-hmm. Let's go. Thank you very much, Brett, for your call. Eli in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just, listening to the program, and I've been listening from the very start, it almost seems sexist. That you have to, if you're a woman, that you understand these things, and you have to come from a women's point of view. Aren't we all human beings, and don't we all care for each other? It's really kind of, it's offensive to me that, you know, it has to be the first woman, and it's, you know, equally, your guest is talking about Obama being the first black president. It's reminding me so much that you can only be black to understand racism. Racism is everywhere. I mean, I don't understand. You know, this man is very, your guest is very learned and very intelligent. I don't understand how that this can keep on being promoted and taught. I'd love to hear an explanation as to why, you know, women, you have to be a woman to understand a woman's issues, and you have to be a black person to understand racism. It just, I find that offensive.
All right, Eli, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, spiritually, as human beings, we're all part of the human family, right? And, you know, when we go inside a church or a temple or a synagogue, we all feel that we're part of the large human family. And that is the experience we all want to have and enjoy and connect, right, with our fellow human beings. But, you know, the reality of the situation is that we still have what appears to be gaps. You know, so when you look at the wage gap for women, you know, you'd think it would have closed by now, but it hasn't. That's the reality. There's a huge mortality gap, you know, infant mortality gap when you look at inner cities. So these differences have been documented for a long time, So if we don't pay attention to these differences, they stay with us, you know. So we have to do something through action, through writing books, and through talking about it. So obviously, of course, you know, we're all part of the one human family, and our, you know, our scriptures teach us that, and our, you know, state leaders profess that message. Yet we still live in a world that's, you know, divided at the fault lines.
Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing is we're not an old country, but we're not all that new anymore. And you remind us that it took us until the last 8 years to elect an African-American president. They were all white males, and perhaps this year it'll be a woman. So there was a reason, there was a historical reason why people were crying all over the world and in this country when Barack Obama was elected, and why people were crying at the event that you went to when Hillary Clinton secured the nomination. They've reached the highest echelon of power.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, and it makes a huge difference, right? So my daughter was with me at the convention in Philadelphia when, at the convention, the digital wall, like you pointed out, the, you know, all the 44 presidents were projected in their larger-than-life, you know, persona, from Washington all the way to Lincoln and, you know, Bill Clinton, and then Bush and Obama, right? And then the ceiling just kind of cracked. And my daughter and I, just, you know, she's looking at me, and she's not, obviously, she's never going to, she's 11 years old. She's not going to forget that,
right,
that image. So for young girls, it's a huge, you know, event. Just like, you know, when President Obama came into power, literally there's documented evidence, SAT scores in the African-American community, in the young people who were taking tests at that time, shot up because he inspired so many young inner city children, you know, that are part of the American family. So that's what we're talking about, you know, trying to create more equitable, more just, more humane, and more tolerant, you know, more receptive society that is also receptive to, you know, the immigrants who want to come to this country, who still look up to this country as the beacon of light. And, you know, historically, yeah, I mean, it's very important, you know. So American democracy really set the high bar 250 years ago, and a lot of the countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America are still trying to chase that light. I know that's hard to believe, but it's true, because we live in such conflictual, you know, conflicted, diabolical times.
Right.
But it is true that, however fraught with conflict our democracy is, it is still a high bar in terms of societal development that America achieved. And a lot of countries, you know, I know of India's political system quite a bit. Indian democracy is also trying to emulate, in many ways, the American ideals of equality and representation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eli, very much for your call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Let's go back to this idea, because I'm interested in what your response is to this. We have heard Hillary say, suggest at least once that I'm aware of, that she would have half her cabinet be female, and there would be a lot of people in the White House staff, I'm sure, who would be female too. What difference does that make to advance women's issues to have, and is it necessary to have half of your cabinet female, half of your staff female? Why?
Yeah, I think she said that on one of the interviews, right?
Maybe. Yes, she did, Rachel, I think. Right.
With Rachel Maddow or somebody. Right, exactly. So I think it reflects a kind of a balance, you know, that it should reflect the population of the U.S., which is half women, half men. But in terms of day-to-day decision-making, there's evidence to suggest that women tend to be more inclusive, less hierarchical in decision-making. So they're more inclined to, you know, sit down and discuss and compromise, which is something that's sorely needed right now in our political system in terms of the gridlock that we've had for the last 8 years in Congress and the executive branch. So, and given Hillary Clinton's experience as a senator working with the opposite side of the aisle, with Republicans in particular, Lindsey Graham, John McCain, and others speak very highly of her, Bob Gates, you know, who's not a Democrat, last I checked. All of these staunchly Republican men speak very highly of her ability to work across the aisle. That is what we need. So what potentially we may have, if we get a representative cabinet with more women in positions of power, you may see the gridlock, giving way. Again, based on evidence, I'm saying this, the way women sort of decide. Now, some of this is evolutionary, biological, some of it is sociological and cultural, right? So earlier, as we were saying, technology has made a lot of jobs automated, right, where you needed physical power. Now, women are entering the military. They're in construction. They're doing a lot of the heavy lifting that traditionally men used to do. So we're facing partly a backlash of that, but also an opening up in terms of more equity, more opportunity for all.
Mm-hmm. Where do you get this from the book about Hillary? In most parts, you have said, of Africa and Asia, Hillary Clinton has worked as a diplomat, and she is very popular. How do we know that?
Oh, this is based on surveys. So The Economist and several of the other European polling agencies have done surveys just recently showing that the world overwhelmingly prefers her over Donald Trump.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we are talking this hour about, well, a number of issues. We're talking about the influence of women in Barack Obama's life and what it would mean to the world and the kinds of issues that Hillary Clinton has focused on during her time as Secretary of State and also as First Lady. And this whole idea of entering an era where women's political power seems to be entering a new era, a stronger era. Is that a good thing? What does that mean in terms of the issues that are presented to the world and in terms of the world engaging in those kinds of issues? That's what's on the table this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You've written fairly extensively about President Obama and the influences on him. We've talked a little bit about his mother, Ann Dunham, but there are lots of women who he's put in prominent positions in his cabinet and other women who've been highly influential in his life. Can we talk more about that, who they are?
Absolutely. So Madeleine Dunham is his maternal grandmother who raised him from the age of 10 onwards, was one of his role models. He describes her as the pragmatic backbone of his early upbringing. He says, I think someplace in Dreams for My Father, that she was the opposite of a dreamer. She worked at the Bank of Hawaii. She rose from the role of a secretary to vice president. And he says that he learned his pragmatism from her. So she was a key figure in his life. And based on my interviews with his sister, Maya Satoru Ng, who was confided in me to say, well, Michelle Obama in many ways is like his grandmother, Madeleine Dunham. Both are very grounded, very pragmatic. And again, this is based on interviews that I've done with people who know President Obama's life history. That's what I learned. Now, of course, he's put a lot of women in positions of power, all the way from Valerie Jarrett, as you mentioned, Kathleen Sebelius, but also his two appointments to the Supreme Court, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, mm-hmm. have been women. His foreign policy advisor, Susan Rice, Amanda Powers. Mm-hmm. Have been leading on the foreign policy front. His appointment for Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen. I make the argument in my books that some of this in President Obama's life really comes from his early socialization, from the fact that he had a strong mother who raised him, and then a strong grandmother who raised him. And, of course, he married, I think his mentee, his mentor.
Yes.
After he was interning at a law firm in Chicago, Michelle Robinson, and I think there's a movie out about how they met now as well.
I haven't seen that. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen the movie yet.
I haven't either.
Yeah, but I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, I do too. And she, what's interesting is he married a woman whose credentials are quite similar to his, right? I mean, she could, we could be seeing another down the road. Who knows if she's interested? She may not be at all, but she could put her name up there for president and people wouldn't think twice about her being in the running, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, and she's a great orator, right? You've heard her speak.
Yes, she is.
On the stump lately, yeah. So, and President Obama's style of leadership as well, and we, I do talk about this in the book, is more empathic and more listening style. It's kind of the anti-Trump, if you will, or the Trump style is more anti-Obama, whatever, however you want to play that off. But, you know, it's not bombastic. It's more controlled. It's more calculated. It's more premeditated. And it's, you know, taking a step back and listening style of leadership, right? It's not that he's disengaged, because a lot of times in the first term, people thought he was disengaged a lot. It's, you know, which kind of gives people the message that he's aloof or not emoting.
He's too cool.
Exactly. Yeah. These are some of the things that people have said about his style of leadership. But what it is that he's, you know, he's more analytical, takes things from a distance, processes them and analyzes them, and then, you know, takes time to make a decision, takes everybody's advice in, into consideration, and so on and so forth. So it's a different style of leadership. And in Trump, you see clearly the opposite style of leadership.
Let's go to Bob Land O'Lakes. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Just fine, thanks. Just a quick comment about, you know, somebody, the callers, even some of the women from the last hour, you know, it just illustrates how pervasive white privilege is and how blind most white people are to this. I mean, you're talking about Barack Obama. He's a man of incredible integrity. Imagine just for a minute if Barack Obama or any other black man spoke or had recordings released like Donald Trump has in the last week, speaking about women the way he has in a denigrating way, what that would have done to Barack Obama's career and reputation. I mean, or any person of color running for office, it would have destroyed their career. But because Donald Trump is white, we allow this type of language. He's given license. And, you know, even women, for God's sakes, are forgiving him for this, so this type of behavior.
Well, it may have sunk the presidency for him, though. Don't you think, Bob?
Sorry?
Don't you think it may have sunk the presidency? The news certainly hasn't been all good for Donald Trump the last few days.
Yeah, of course not. But people would never forgive this type of behavior from a black man.
Yeah, I see your point. What do you think, Professor Sharma?
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, so clearly, you know, President Obama represents, as I say in the book, kind of the Sidney Poitier-like image of a cool black professor, you know, who doesn't talk down to you, who respects what you or tries to hear and listen empathically, connect with, you know, the general population. And that is really how he got the women's vote. But you look at the results in 2008 and 2012, based on the evidence, you know, he won the women's vote based on the fact that he was able to persuade and connect the general population. You know, he got obviously majority of the African American vote, Hispanic vote, and a significant percentage of the Asian American vote as well. And I think that's the cultural part that we're seeing here in terms of the transition. The demographic part of the country that is less educated, again, based on the Trump vote, predominantly white, rural, is the one that's backing him. You know, and the part of the country that's kind of demographically more diverse is with Hillary Clinton. So we see that play out in the debate. You know, and, you know, the transition that is taking place with the first woman president is a global transition. I mean, this is something that we're seeing also in the UK. We have Prime Minister May in the UK, Angela Merkel in Germany. So for the first time, we have Western powers potentially, we'll find out in about a month, run, you know, managed by women.
Thank you, Bob, for your call. Morgan in Milwaukee. Hi, Morgan.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I just want to comment on everything. It's just so interesting because I'm 30 years old, you know, met in between, millennial compared, Gen X and whatnot, and those older generations of where my grandpa used to walk around and use the term, spooks, and to, now my son is 6 who doesn't even see anybody, color as a thing or calling people by, color. And it's all about face, having women, having the face of the nation. We all know by now that she, people, the president, can just do whatever they want. And she knows that, so she doesn't promise all these things that she knows that may take time to deliver. And how can you have, how can you have a guy, a guy like Trump go in front of the nation and, have the one power? What can he do? Declare war, right? That's the one thing he can do, right? Give him that power. Now, all these men back that up because they have the fear of the unknown of something, having a woman be in charge. They can't just see that because they're stuck, especially these older generations. These women as should be in the kitchen, not doing things. So it's time for them, when they go away.
Professor Sharma.
Yeah, right. I mean, I think we're not saying that all women make great leaders necessarily, because we've had the, women leaders who've not necessarily made the best decisions. But certainly in this country, we're looking at this watershed moment, I think, because of demographic changes that have taken place in the country, where the country is becoming more diverse, and because of globalization, where the world is looking to America to offer solutions to a lot of the challenges that we face, whether it's automation, technology, or terrorism. And America still finds itself in a position where it can lead. And now we have a candidate who, as the president said, President Obama said, very qualified on paper, who happens to be a woman.
Things are changing. They are. I mean, there are significant changes that are happening in terms of the makeup of our country.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, things are changing for the better. The doom and gloom message that you hear doesn't bear out based on the facts. We know that around the world, people are living longer, they're healthier. We know in the United States itself, people have a lot more access to media, technology, to means of transportation and education. So the idea that make America great again, I think clearly resonates partly with this cultural shift that's taking place. Mm. When you ask, a lot of the African American mothers and young people of an earlier generation or millennials, they say, make America great for whom? Right? 50 years ago, it wasn't so great for everybody.
More phone calls, 800-486-8655. We're talking about global leadership. We're talking about the formation of values and ideas that women have been important in shaping in President Obama and perhaps in how Hillary Clinton would govern as President of the United States. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dale, our next caller in River Falls. Hi, Dale.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd be curious in hearing your guest's perspectives on a dynamic that we don't really hear a whole lot about, and that is the role of, a potential role of Bill Clinton as, I'm not even sure what to call him, is it the first man, is it the first gentleman? So there's two factors. One, first, that we've never had a first man before, and second, the fact that he would be a former U.S. president.
Okay. Professor?
So he's, I think, jokingly said at several of the rallies that he's happy to break that glass ceiling to be the first spouse. I don't know what the best title would be for him because he's already been president. Maybe, first spouse or first man. I mean, I don't know. Again, I'm sure these are things that the campaign is probably working on in terms of titles. But, it is a historical first. We've not had a former president whose wife then went on to become senator and secretary of state and now is the nominee on the major party ticket. you know, just as we've not had, you know, the issues related to all the foundation stuff that, that they've been working on for years and years. So I think we're in uncharted waters. And I think, you know, we men will appreciate as well the cultural change that's taking place here.
Let's go to Mary in St. Paul. Hello, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had heard a previous caller call in, and he was saying how, you know, why do you have to be a minority to understand racism, and why do you have to be a woman to understand these rights? And he was saying that he didn't understand that because he, you know, was very, sounds like he's very empathetic with these issues. But I did want to point out that, you know, as a woman, there's so much that you see when you're growing up as a kid, and the sexism and the glass ceilings and things that happen, and that you could be the most empathetic person in the world, but until you've lived it and you've seen it and you don't know how to react, and it's like until you've lived it, you can't truly understand. And I'm not belittling the guy that called, because he sounds like a great guy, but until you've lived it, it's just so different. And I wanted to say, I live a couple blocks from where Philando Castile, where that shooting occurred in July. Mm-hmm. And I feel, I'm a very liberal person, and I feel, you know, that I'm very fair, and I you know, I'm against all the prejudice and all that stuff. But until I heard a lot of the people coming to the city council and talking about how they are treated in that area and how different it is from me, and I'm like, gosh, I really didn't have a clue. As empathetic and as liberal as I am about equal rights for everyone, I still find myself like, wow, I had no idea, and I'm sure there's more I don't know about. So I just think until you are, you know, that minority, or you are a woman, or you are whatever it is that's being, you know, held back, until you are that person, you can know as much as you can, but you can't know as much as there is. And there's that whole inherent prejudice as well, you know, stuff you don't even know that you're prejudiced about, because it's just how you've grown up.
Mm-hmm. So you're listening and learning. Dinesh.
Yes, yes. So there's a lot of research on unconscious bias, implicit bias, and some of this came up in the first debate in terms of police shootings taking place in inner cities, you know. And a lot, you know, obviously that has to do with our cultural sort of lenses that we wear, has to be corrected based on training, better community policing, the better police-community relations, and so on and so forth. And so, yes, I mean, we have to be mindful of the fact that the world around us is changing, and we have to be tolerant, open-minded, and accepting of difference. But, you know, our biases creep in. The other thing that's going on, partly in this election we haven't talked much about, is really the aging, you know, that both of the candidates are in their 60s and 70s, and they're both grandparents. So we're the other thing we're seeing, secular trends that are happening in America, along with the demographic changes, along with the global changes, the aging of America, and so you could argue, you know, that we're becoming wiser. You know, now we have potentially the first woman who's a grandmother, and obviously Trump is also a grandfather. So we're looking at potentially, you know, America aging and becoming more wiser historically.
We're also, though, looking at this figure, just was notable to me, that Pew Research figure, that there are more 24-year-olds in this country than any other age. 24-year-olds, so that's a whole, and they appear to be a different kind of generation, really. Much more liberal.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Much more liberal, and they want, you know, they were rooting for Bernie Sanders, you know, early on, or Gary Johnson. You know, Bernie Sanders, I can still understand, you know, in terms of the college tuition issue, better health care, better access to jobs when they come out of college. And I think the Sanders team really hit on a key message there. But a lot of that has now been incorporated into the platform, the Democratic platform. And with this generational shift, obviously, we're seeing the country, you know, using the term socialist, which in an earlier era, you know, was a code word for communism, now coming into vogue. because again, people are wanting more equality, more representation in their government, and more access to their politicians. So in that respect, we had, you know, in the primaries and in the general election, we had candidates that were mature.
And
clearly representing those issues as well.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Dinesh, thank you so much for being with us. Interesting hour.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Appreciate you. Dinesh Sharma, his books are The Global Obama, Crossroads of Leadership in the 21st Century, and The Global Hillary, Women's Political Development in Cultural Contexts. Thanks to KP Whaley for production, and thanks to Scotty Myers and Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, the New York Times contributing writer who wrote the long piece, excellent piece, about what's happening with conservative radio in this country as a result of Donald Trump.